Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Thinking Out Loud with my friend and colleague, Gene Tavernetti. My name is Zach Groeschel, and we're going to keep on thinking out loud about different moments and topics that we've come across in the world of instructional leadership and effective instruction. Gene, how are you doing today?
You know what? I am doing great today, Zach. It's good to be here with you again and to talk about really a critical topic, just how do we support teachers best?
Yes, and so there's two ways to think of a starting point when it comes to beginning instructional coaching. Ultimately, we want to shape all the different various behaviors and techniques and strategies so that teachers have the ability to make judgments in the classroom and to think on their own when it comes to deploying these strategies. We can split this up into two different ways. And you and I have gone back and forth a little bit around like a chicken and an egg type of situation. And let me describe it for listeners. It's this. One approach to instructional coaching would be to walk into the classroom, observe a moment, and pinpoint a technique, like usually a delivery technique, such as choral response or mini whiteboards, or just something that's needed in terms of the teacher's presence, the teacher's nonverbal cues, what they do during independent practice, and so on. And so that's sort of like a step. It's small, it's a technique, it's observable, and we can work on it with the teacher. There's another approach, which is very carefully laid out in your book, Teach Fast, and then in the follow-up book for coaching, Maximizing Coaching Cycles, where you might want to emphasize the design of the lesson rather than focusing on a single technique in that coaching conversation. And there seems to be a lot of agreement between us of when this is necessary, but it's a question that comes up between me and a lot of different aspiring coaches is what happens when this happens and where do you start? It's a bit of a chicken and the egg. Do we focus on the lesson design or do we focus on specific techniques?
You know, it's interesting. I love the way that you laid that out. You know, somebody told me recently, they said, oh, you're the coaching guy. And I was almost offended. I said, yeah, I do talk about coaching a lot, but only as it regards to supporting good instruction. And I think I listened to you and followed you and what you were doing and everybody who was talking about coaching for probably a year. And I, every time I listened, I would be upset because I'm thinking, where's the lesson? Where's the lesson in this? Because it was all technique. And we always started from the design of the lesson. You know, let's get a good lesson here, because you could have all the techniques, but you know, you could get the kids' attention in various ways. But once you had the kids' attention, then what? What were you going to do? So we always focused on helping teachers design and deliver well thought out lessons, well sequenced lessons, coherent lessons. And we always did that. And then recently, been working with a couple teachers, and I'm thinking, wow, they need a lot of these techniques to get going. And I don't know if I was just lucky and I was working with teachers who had already established some of these things, because in my way of thinking, there are many of these techniques that are what teachers do like naturally. And I'm not saying that teachers can't be developed, but there are some people, you just look at them, you watch them teach once, they're brand new, and you think, wow, that person's a teacher, because they have all of these techniques embedded that they got someplace. But so I was in the we've got to do the lesson design camp first. I was always there. And then until recently, I realized, man, there's so much lacking that gets in the way of even an average delivery of a good, well-designed lesson.
I think that you're onto something when you say that there is a very key and important role to situating these techniques within a design sequence, within an architecture of how a well-designed lesson should proceed. In shorthand, we could call this kind of the Frankenstein lesson, where the teacher teaches with all of these interesting techniques that they've heard about, they've read from Teach Like a Champion, or they watched the Step Lab documentary and they saw Pritesh and they took out some of those things and they tried their best to do merits and demerits, and they try their best to do mini whiteboards, and they try their best to do retrieval practice. And basically, you put it all together, you crunch it all together, and okay, it's alive. It's a Frankenstein, though. It's alive. It's stitched together improperly, and certain things don't follow the assumptions of the things that preceded it. And actually, it's very similar without that lesson design framework to a bunch of isolated activities that aren't, you couldn't actually call, reasonably call a lesson. I mean, that is a risk of going towards the techniques.
Yes, and I want to be sure that we give Joe Finch credit for the name, the Frankenstein Lesson, because he was one of those folks, and he's going to be on podcast soon to talk about this himself. But he had, like many folks, in the last year or so, had become enamored. He found out about the science of learning. He learned all these techniques, and he had them all. He sent me a video. I think he sent it to you first, and then you shared it. And you could just see, oh, there's that technique. There's the turn of talk. There's this. He's got his strategies, and he's got a routine for how to use the whiteboards, and he's got all of those things. And that wasn't the issue. The issue was, a well-designed, well-sequenced lesson so that the kids could gain access to the content more easily. So anyway, shout out to Joe for the Frankenstein lesson name.
I want to tee you up for a second on something we didn't plan to do. I just think it's important. Like we're talking too generally in my if, for my preference for what a well-designed lesson is. Like, could you perhaps, even though you don't have the whiteboard and the magnets and are visual here, could you perhaps like talk me through the what that entails in terms of the order that it's planned and the thinking that goes into each of the categories that's inside of a lesson planning framework?
A well-designed lesson, we use the FAST framework that embeds all of Rosenshine's principles. It operationalizes all of Rosenshine's principles. And instead of talking about a planning order, we'll just talk about how a lesson is delivered. And there isn't much debate that we build new knowledge based on prior knowledge. So the lesson starts out with the kids retrieving prior knowledge and conceptual knowledge. So conceptual knowledge based on things that they've experienced just because they've been alive for X number of years. And so start out with that. We let the kids know what our learning objective is. It's very clear what they're going to be doing, but it's also that learning objective. It makes it also very clear to the teacher where they're going with the lesson. Otherwise, you can't manage your cognitive load. You don't know what's extraneous or not. So we go from activating prior knowledge that is specific to the lesson, develop the conceptual knowledge, big ideas that are going to be necessary to perform the task. And then after we're sure the kids have a grasp on that content, then we move on to modeling. Now, I've described this before, and people say, oh, so you're saying we have to do concepts first? Well, only the concept that's related to getting to today's information. We don't have to spend days on the concept. But so we've moved from prior knowledge, learning objective, what are the key concepts, modeling with a procedure, breaking things down into little steps. You can just see all of Rosenshine, oozing out of this. And then we're going to do a gradual release in guided practice. So we're going to do one step at a time until we're sure that the kids have it. We're going to do a closure activity. Again, what are we doing? We're doing retrieval. And then finally, they're going to do some independent practice. And everything is related. Each of those components is related. So as we move from component to component, kids move seamlessly through the lesson.
How long does that typically take to do what would be considered a lesson?
In the lower grades, like first grade, second grade, God, maybe 25 minutes. In the secondary, 40, 45 minutes. And the reason that we're able to do that is we're identifying all the things that are essential and all the non-essential. Because so much of the time that it takes in lessons is taken up by things that just aren't adding to the students being able to learn or do whatever the objective is of the day.
Love it. And so that kind of framework, and many people will recognize elements of this from different things they've heard before. I know that in the in I hated it because in my university, we basically had a very convoluted version of this where you do like 6 pages of like filling in boxes for what if this learner has this sort of need and what if this, how are you going to relate it to the real world problems of of society, and how are you know, there were all these strange sociology things that kind of got embedded into it. But if you stripped away the fluff, it underlying that was you need to know what the kids are going to do by the end of the lesson, specifically, like nothing, you need to know, like be able to show me, write it down, this is exactly it. And I need to tell them that at the very beginning. And then I need essentially gradually release the students into that opportunity through unpacking the key de declarative knowledge, unpacking the procedure, seeing that they can do parts of it at a time. What I love when you talk about the gradual releases is you can break it down so small that they can get into the first part of it very early, as opposed to like seeing almost an entire new model from a teacher when you do that, when you do that gradual release. And so then basically combining steps and bringing it to the point where I can see and check that everyone can do it, check for a closure, just like, can you do this? And can you articulate this with a couple of my key questions? Can you teach someone else like how to do it, like your partner? And then, okay, I'm feeling really good. Into independent practice, folks, let's learn this a ton. I don't need to monitor and like in a very vigorous way, because I've already assessed that it's pretty good. I might need to meet with some individuals. I've got my clipboard perhaps, and I'm going around actively observing or pulling some key students. And you've basically got a 25 to 35 minute chunk of the day that can be situated within your do now, between your do now and your exit ticket, and you've got your period. Am I correct on all this?
Yes. And again, for up until the time I met you, Zach, and I got involved with the Science of Learning cult, I was convinced that that's where you start. I was absolutely convinced that's where you start. I'll give you an example. I was watching a video online about another group that does coaching, and they say, we always start with these behaviors. We always start with giving clear directions. I'm trying to think Doug Lamov's term, what to do?
The what to do cycle,
The
yeah.
what to do cycle. And they would have teachers practice, 15, 20 times, on this what to do cycle. And yeah, you need to know that, but do you need to know it at 100% level? How about if you were 70% there and 70% on the lesson design that we just talked about? Would that be better? I don't know. What's your thoughts on where to start?
Okay, so lesson design, we described it. And you know what? I think the advantage of this is that it avoids the Frankenstein lesson, and it establishes the conditions for future coaching. It's really hard to coach in a scattergun way where you just go from technique to technique to technique. But if you have a backbone that unites the techniques, in the terms of the lesson, then at least it's not that 5-paragraph essay that you need to that's all covered in red ink. You have certain things that you can identify that are at the technique level once you establish a certain baseline for instruction. Now, there's the other side of this coin that you've discovered, and that's that some techniques, especially if you think of a diagnostic chain, some techniques are meant to get the classroom calm and listening. It's meant to get the kids participating. And these things enable the teacher to clear the clutter out of the lesson so that they might be able to deploy a well-designed lesson. I think of like the threshold at the door of the classroom. The teacher just lets the kids all kind of run in. But if I coach the teacher to say, look, I know that like you just kind of want to have a conversation with all the kids and kind of let them come in naturally. Unfortunately, that's not how it works. The kids are going to take that opportunity and they're going to run your room amok. So what I'll have you do is just stand here at the door, and I'll just go ahead and show you how I lean in and I lean out and I stop one kid at a time. And if there's a few kids inside that are messing about, I exit the classroom and I talk to them and we try it again. If you need help, of course, you call the administrator, right? But what happens is I start at that level, and all of a sudden, I get success. I get motivation coming out of the teacher. I'm like, Well, look, my due now started all right, right? You're like, great. Let's talk about that due now for a second. That due now needs to be all prior learning, and it should not be something where they construct new meaning, because guess what? Kids misbehave when they don't know what they're doing. So let's design some due nows together. Great. You checked off the threshold. You checked off the due now. Let me tell you about learning objectives, right? And you sort of take a different approach, which is manageable for the teacher in terms of their cognitive load. The coach certainly needs to sequence it so it's in a deliberate order, but it's small enough to be achieved in a single coaching cycle, and it creates motivation in the sense of success is practically guaranteed in a very short amount of time. That would be my description of why that other approach is so popular. What are your thoughts as I just said that?
My first thought is goes back to something that we have talked about many times, and that is how important it is before a coach, whether it's an internal coach, whether it's a consultant, etc., gives any sort of feedback, they need to know what the usual routine of the teacher is. Because you were talking about that entry routine. And making a connection with the student and very quickly and all of that. Now, I observed a lesson the other day where the teacher had a do now. Teacher had a do now on the board, and it was an ELA class, high school. They were doing some writing, and they had to do something. It was a do now based on prior lesson. And so as soon as they were done, they brought it to the teacher for a stamp, that they had done it. And the other purpose, that teacher made a personal connection comment in like 5 seconds with every student. So the reason that I say that, he has accomplished what you described, entry routine. So he obviously had an entry routine that worked, made the connection. Every kid was working. Now, if I hadn't seen that and I had said, well, let's talk about your entry routine. What do you do when the kids walk in? I'd have lost that teacher. I'd have lost all credibility because you are accomplishing what needs to be accomplished, but you're doing it a little bit differently. And who cares if it's effective? But had I started talking sooner, I'd have lost the teacher. So for any coach, any administrator, anybody, before you start giving advice about anything, be sure you understand what's happening in that classroom with that teacher in particular.
Absolutely. And the same goes with do now. It's like I run in and I say, hey, I have this idea for a do now. And it's like, it's not the established routine of the school. I mean, now you're having a teacher do something that you personally think would work, even though I think starting with retrieval practice is a decently good bet to help you get your attendance done. Maybe that's not the starting point for the school. And there's some need to like back up too when it comes to the technique level and go like, what is the school's instructional focus for the year, for their PD, and so on? Like, I have here my evergreen classroom for my school in Manitoba, in Gimli, Manitoba, the best school in that province. And they have the list of their techniques that they are working on as part of their focus. And so, what it does is it shortcuts this whole need to like, sit in persuasion with a teacher around why it's important because we've already done a lot of PD on it. It's sort of more like which of these is going to help move you forward the fastest, and which of these are the things you haven't touched upon in your PD with me lately. That's sort of a risk as well, right? Is sort of you at the technique level, you're not talking about a process, you're talking about a specific behavior. And the better that you do it, the more precise you do it, and the more nitpicky you are about it, the more aversive it could be to the person if they feel like this isn't me, this isn't what I do. It certainly works a lot better if everybody's rowing the boat together in a school, and we've already talked about all these things.
Absolutely. And I think a couple of things that we've talked about with regards to you've had examples of techniques, getting into the room, having a do now. Now, I want to differentiate between what an outside consultant, I'm going to give some advice to folks hiring an outside consultant. Who should do that work versus who needs to do the other work that you just described with all the techniques?
Yeah, they have the Evergreen 8 is what
They
they
have
call it.
okay. They have the Evergreen Eight, which is tied to designing and delivering lessons. So what I tell, folks who I'm working with, you know what? Don't pay us as much as you pay us every day, for a daily rate to train a teacher or to talk to a teacher about standing at the door. I'm sure you have teachers who are doing a great job at greeting kids, talking to them, telling them, what's expected of them as they walk through the door, greet them, all of those things. Save your money for the things that people don't know what to do in the building, and let us outside consultants work on that and work on your internal folks so that they can pick it up later. Because the internal folks should have better answers to our questions about where you begin, because they should be able to see the teachers more frequently and design, what's the point of leverage? Where should I start? Where am I going to get the most bang for a buck working with this teacher? Because I think the goal should be in coaching teachers is the least amount of coaching necessary. Because I think the real goal is to have that culture in the school where teachers are to be able to have these collegial conversations where they're actually, doing the work with each other. And I think we only do that if we're not this picky, 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 picky. It's easy to go in and find something. But what we really want is there are good things going on overall. Are they impactful? Are they having the impact that we know the research talks about that it should have? And once we get that, work on it to perfect it. And we don't have to live in their classroom to do that.
A simple technique would be the intro routine and the do now. You know what? Every classroom needs to work on, right? And that's not those. But every classroom needs to work on is essentially checking for understanding throughout the entire lesson. I've now been to 400 lessons this trimester, whatever it has been, right? And when you find a teacher who at every interval checks for understanding, you get goosebumps and you want to throw a parade in their favor. And but the majority of lessons, regardless if they take a discovery approach or a lecture approach or an explicit instruction approach, just as lacking in this very important skill of check, and if not, reteach, adjust, readjust based on the formative data that you are getting in real time. The teachers are struggling to deploy the lesson, and that it leaves them without the cognitive bandwidth, I believe, to be able to choose a question on the fly that will enable them to decide at a hinge point whether or not I move forward or don't. It's very cognitively demanding. So the argument for being very precise and picky about techniques and getting them to practice it 25 times, as you alluded to, would be that if you can do the technique in and out, divorced from content, then when you are in your classroom and you're meant to cold call, choral response, mini whiteboards, turn and talk, when you're in that mode, you don't need to think about the in cue and the out cue and my hand and how I drop it and how I deploy the technique. I have that down in pat from the training I had or the coaching I had. And now I can think about the content. I can think about what the kids are saying. I have the cognitive space to listen to to do the hard part, which is to listen to what they're doing and saying, and then make a determination in real time of what I do. I think that that's the theory behind this, and I think that that's why there's some element of like why you would want to over practice these techniques when you're not seeing them in a school. Thoughts?
Boy, every time you talk like that, Zach, I'm convinced, to that the lesson design is not that important. But yes, I think it. I think we're going to get down to a yes and here, because everything that you just described needs to happen. But when you talk about a hinge point in a lesson, the only way to provide the context to working with a teacher about what's a hinge question is having them understand what those components are and how are we going to move out of it. So it is those techniques within the context of the lesson and now making the decision. And what we really want to have done in a well-designed lesson is to be able to have a place to go, whether we're getting this checking for understanding, we're getting this data. And now the responsive teaching is either going to move, we're going to move on because they have it, or move back to a prior part in the lesson. And so We can only do that if we have the lesson designed well. So I still don't, know. This is my conundrum. Well, before we started recording, we were talking about another technique, and like choral response. And I think, you schooled me in how to do choral response, I think in 15 seconds. It's so important, but I don't want, getting back to coaching, I don't want to take a technique that we could talk about in 15 seconds. Yeah, let's not say 15 seconds, but because we'd have to talk about not only, the cues and how to get the kids to do it, but also how much content do you want to do? When is it appropriate? When is it appropriate to do a choral response? When is it going to get in the way? Because, we don't want the kids to give us, wanting to have three sentences in a choral response, even if it's written. I mean, there's more things to learn, but I don't want to have them have to go through a Wednesday, a whole PD on choral response. And again, I don't think you need to pay us big bucks to go in there and train you how to do it. What's your thoughts on?
Well, certainly not one technique, but I think maybe like a cluster could be you could suitably, right? I
Yeah.
especially if you say like this constitutes a framework for getting all students to participate 100% of the time, and we know that sitting here in the center is turn and talk, for example, right? It helps. What does it do? It helps you unpack the content if you j are not sure of it with someone else. Helps you revoice what the teacher just said. It can be used for retrieval. Let's practice come some of these elements. Now, look, you might want to get them to write before, write, pair, share, right? And so, what are some of the directions that are necessary to get everyone 100% pencils moving in 3, 2, 1, lean my neck, right? And you
Yeah.
practice that element and you go, but you know what? After the turn and talk, you're going to have to cold call, right? You know? And so you
Yeah.
create like a bit of a cluster, I guess. I wouldn't say that a single technique could last. That's why. In the StepLab terminology, group rehearsal lasting about 7 minutes on a technique is about as much time as you need. Like, here, look how I do it. All right, with the person next to you, unpack what I just did. It only takes 7 minutes. It wouldn't be an hour of training, you know?
Right. I want to be sure that the time we spend with teachers is well spent. And I also want to, before we do something like that, before I do something like that, I want to know who the teachers are who are doing a good job already doing it. I want to recognize them. I don't want them, rolling their eyes because I know how to do this. I know you know how to do it. That's why I'm recognizing you as someone who knows how to do this, who can attest, who could testify to its effectiveness and how it's so much better than what you used to do, how it's not that hard to implement, et cetera, et cetera. I want them as an ally versus, again, people rolling their eyes, especially as we work with secondary, because some of the things that we're going to ask teachers to do with those techniques are exactly the same techniques that they're doing in kindergarten. Doesn't mean they're not effective.
Absolutely. So the metaphor of the camera lens, and this is an elaboration theory thing, is really important to me in this whole part whole situation, right? We have the whole, which is the lesson design, and sort of all the hooks that these techniques need to hang on. And then we have the parts, which are the techniques. And we have disadvantages and advantages of starting in either one because the whole might be overwhelming for the teacher and sense that here's how you do a whole lesson. And by the way, we need to do a bunch of these in order for you to get the point, right? Right.
Right.
And the parts, while smaller and more co less cognitively demanding, often without the context, without where they're situated, they sort of can contribute to Frankenstein style teaching. I think of the camera lens. Have you ever been to see Guernica, the P Pablo Picasso big painting? It has all of these different odd looking characters that are all in this enormous painting. And if you look at the whole thing without looking at each individual character, it's gorgeous, but I don't really know what I'm looking at, right? It's too
Right.
big. That's the lesson design, perhaps. And then when you, but what you need to do is like a camera, you need to zoom in on one character and scrutinize it. And then, very importantly, zoom back out and see how it relates to the other character. Is it touching this other character? Is it in a cluster with this one? Are they relating to each other? And you go in and out in an elaborative sense. Elaboration theory is what I'm describing, where you go in and out like a camera. And ultimately, over time, I think that's how you grow teachers' expertise. So it's kind of both, but I don't know if we answered the chicken and the egg starting
I,
point.
you know, I don't think so, because I think the starting point is observing a teacher doing stuff, you know, because that's going to tell us where to begin. It's going to tell us what we don't have to cover. And now we're just talking about what we're going to talk about before we see a lesson, because all of this is about responsive teaching. So we still have to observe a teacher within the context of teaching a real lesson, and then that will give us another clue about where to go next.
And you can't do any of that. You should listen to the other episodes, folks. You can't do any of that if you don't have a game plan and a route for how to get into classrooms, and you stop. I'll just be spicy because it's the end of the episode, and you stop being scared to open that door and to walk on in and create a plan for where you see all teachers and coach all teachers. If you're sitting in the realm of, I hope someone comes to me and comes and looks at my menu that I have posted on the bathroom stalls, you're never going to end up observing. You're never going to end up observing teaching. You got to go in there and you got to start making these coaching cycles happen.
Yes. And our worst fears about that, about what is going to happen with these teachers, it is such a small percentage of the time. In fact, I think, you know, people talk about, you know, how do you work with reluctant teachers? Well, ask them what the issues are. Many of the issues are legitimate issues. I don't want to work with you. Last time somebody came in, they told me I had to do everything differently. Well, I'm not going to do that. What else are you upset about? And just go through, find out what it is. Find out what it is that is upsetting them. And you know what? That's not that scary to have that conversation. What's scary is to try to convince somebody to do something that they don't want to do. I would rather know what's the issue, and because you know, and there I've told, you know, administrators this, I don't want to meet with that teacher again. Not because they weren't good people, they're not nice people. It's just they're not going to listen to me. Pay me to have somebody, you know, to talk to somebody who's going to listen to me, and we'll try it. But how do you know that, Zach? What Dr. Groeschel just said, you got to get out there and get in those classrooms and see what's going on.
Gene, as usual, these conversations, they bring me a lot of joy, and I hope that other people feel that, that this is helping them as well. Sometimes it feels a little bit like inside baseball, but if you've been in coaching long enough, I hope you keep following our trains of thoughts, our separate sort of avenues of thinking, and then it can kind of help you to manage these situations. I think instructional coaching is the best form of PD, and so I really do appreciate the conversations.
Yeah, just say one thing. I mean, it's easy to think, oh, this is for coaches. No, this is for anyone who helps support teachers. Because if you're a district administrator who's going to hire consultants, you need to think about this. You need to consider this. You need to know where your teachers are. If you're a site administrator, you need to know this. If you're an instructional coach, you need to know this. And I think it's good for teachers to understand what is the point of view of these people coming in to coach?
And at that, listeners, thank you so much for tuning in to Thinking Out Loud. We hope to continue having you tune in and give this a 5-star rating, pass it around, and let's make effective instruction available to all kids.